funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, new numbers on the economy show growth at a rate unseen in 20 years. We'll ask why, and will it last?
Congress considers a massive tax cut, this time for corporations.
And some in Congress argue passionately to let Americans buy their prescription drugs more cheaply from other countries.
I want our pharmacists and distributors to be able to purchase that FDA-approved drug wherever it is sold. Let the market system provide benefits to the American consumers.
Also, Hong Kong braces for a recurrence of SARS.
The age of child brides in Afghanistan, it's now 7.
And The Human Stain, a great book, now a movie. These stories and more coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Senate Republicans have been unable to break a Democratic filibuster holding up a vote on U.S. District Judge Charles Pickering's promotion to the Federal Appeals Court. NPR's David Wellner tells us why the Democrats oppose the nomination.
Democrats oppose Charles Pickering both because they say as a U.S. District Court judge, he showed undue sympathy toward a convicted cross-burner in his sentencing about a decade ago. They also say that he's been hostile towards civil rights claims in general and towards voting rights and labor issues. And they say that his record is not one that gives him the kind of qualifications needed to sit on the nation's second highest court.
NPR's David Wellness speaking to us from the Capitol. Embattled firefighters in the San Bernardino Mountains east of Los Angeles appear to have cut off a rampaging fire that was expected to explode when flames hit the tinder dry area near Lake Arrowhead. From member station KCRW, Eric Roy reports.
Discouraged firefighters watched as fire jumped a mountain highway they'd been using as a fire break and blew into Lake Arrowhead, where it burned down 350 homes at Cedar Glen. With hundreds of thousands of dead trees in the Arrowhead Basin, experts thought any fire would be unstoppable. But Bureau of Land Management spokesman Bob Norris says fire crews seem to have stopped the fire from spreading around the lake.
In Cedar Glen itself, no additional reports of structures lost or active fire in that area.
Norris also says fire crews have apparently blocked the fire from moving toward the Big Bear Ski Resort area. Norris says the fire is spreading to the north and west away from Lake Arrowhead, and he stresses that firefighters are not out of the woods yet. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
An explosion rocked Baghdad's old quarter today, sparking a large fire and killing at least one person. There's no information yet on what caused the blaze. In Atlantic City, New Jersey, a five-story section of a casino parking lot has collapsed. Officials say at least two people were injured and two are missing. The structure at the Tropicana Casino and Resort is under construction. The nation's economy showed stronger than expected strength in the third quarter. The Commerce Department reports a 7.2% rise in the gross domestic product. That's more than double the previous quarter. Hugh Johnson, the chief economist at First Albany Corporation, says consumer spending fueled the increase.
There were tax cuts. Those tax cuts came to about $12 billion. There were $14 billion in refund checks that were sent to consumers. And in addition to that, as you know, we had low interest rates. There was a lot of refinancing of mortgages by consumers, and that, of course, put additional money on a monthly basis in the pockets of spenders.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 11 points to 97.85. The Nasdaq's up 2 points to 19.38. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, a federal bankruptcy judge says he will order Midway Airlines to liquidate its assets. The regional carrier for U.S. Airways has been fighting bankruptcy for 2 years. Since December, U.S. Airways has loaned Midway $8.5 million to keep it flying as a feeder airline. But Midway is running out of money and has not been able to operate its full flight schedule for the past month. Health insurer Aetna is reporting higher quarterly profits. The company says it was able to keep down medical costs and operating expenses. John Dankowski with member station WNPR reports from Hartford.
Aetna more than doubled its net income in the quarter, with $215.9 million or $1.35 a share, compared to $98.8 million or 64 cents a share a year ago. But total revenues were down from $4.8 billion to $4.5 billion. CEO John Rowe called the performance solid, crediting discipline and cost management, and increased full-year guidance for the insurance giant. Aetna has turned itself around after major losses in 2001, which were blamed on acquisitions and customer service problems. Late last week, a federal judge approved an agreement estimated at $470 million between Aetna and the nation's doctors to settle claims that the company routinely skimped on payments to nearly 1 million physicians. The company said it will implement internal changes to process doctors' claims more quickly. For NPR News, I'm John Dankosky in Hartford.
ExxonMobil says its earnings increased during the third quarter to 55 cents a share. Analysts had been expecting a per-share profit of 62 cents. Once again on Wall Street, the Dow up 15 points, the Nasdaq is up 2, the S&P is down 1. I'm Angela Zell, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The economy is going gangbusters again. New figures released by the Commerce Department this morning show the economy erupted to astonishing 7.2% growth from July to the end of September. That's the strongest acceleration in two decades and way beyond what analysts had predicted. Joining us on the line is Mark Zandi, chief economist at economy.com. And Mark, 7.2%, wow, what do you make of it?
Wow, it's a boom-like number. The economy just performed fabulously in the third quarter. Everything came together just at the right time.
Yeah. What do you mean everything came together? I mean, there was been predictions out there for a bit of about 6%, but this 7.2% number really threw people back on their heels. What came together?
Consumers were out spending. They bought a lot of everything from apparel to cars to housing, and even businesses participated. They picked up their investment, particularly in computer hardware and software, but it was more broad-based than that. They were investing in a lot of different things. And even more encouraging was the fact that we were able to sell more of our goods and services to overseas buyers. So exports rose very strongly. So there were numerous sources of growth in the quarter, and it was a great quarter.
Mark, I thought the economy was a mess. Why was everybody out buying up like a storm?
First, we got tax cuts. They were massive. People's withholding schedules were lowered in the quarter. And, of course, many folks with children got a check in the mail. Interest rates got very low. If you remember back in the summer, fixed mortgage rates got down close to 5%. And that juiced up the housing market. And, of course, it made it very easy for homeowners to go out and borrow against the homes. And that's what they did. There was a massive mortgage borrowing. And that helped. All that helped consumer spending. And then, for businesses, there's a very powerful replacement cycle building for information technology. A lot of the hardware and software that businesses invested in a couple, 3 years ago is now no longer economically viable. It's expiring. It's depreciating. And so businesses are being forced to invest in those things just to maintain the quality of the stock of capital that they have in their businesses.
All right, Mark, let's haul out your crystal ball. Will it last?
It will last. Businesses take the next step and begin to hire people. We need to see jobs. Now, if history is any guide, they will. Profits are up. This increase in demand and production should induce businesses to go out and hire people. And if they do, then this recovery will evolve into a self-sustaining rebound. If they don't, this is the key, if they don't, then the economy is going to disappoint everyone next year, much as it has excited everyone this quarter.
Now, Mark, why wouldn't they hire more people? Could it be that productivity rates are at historic highs and companies sort of hold back and figure they're doing okay with what they've got? Why spend more money on paying more people?
Well, that's part of it, and that reflects to some degree a lack of confidence. Businesses have been put through a lot in the last couple, 3 years, you know, everything from terrorism to wars and corporate accounting scandals, and businesses are chastened by all of that, and I think are a little bit wary to go out and become a little bit more aggressive, and that's reflected in their lack of hiring and some of these better productivity numbers. And it's also related to offshoring of jobs. Businesses have figured out ways to move lots of jobs and production overseas to take advantage of the lower cost of operating in those other countries, and that's also weighing on the job market. So, you know, we should take solace in these numbers. It's a very positive number. The economy clearly is headed in the right direction, but we should also be very cautious here. The economy has yet to evolve into a self-sustaining rebound. We're not out of the woods yet.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at economy.com. Thanks so much, Mark.
It was a pleasure.
The House Ways and Means Committee this week approved a $128 billion corporate tax cut. The bill is touted as increasing the competitiveness of American companies, but some critics, including some Republican congressmen, say it will send more American jobs overseas. The House bill, which must now be reconciled with a more modest Senate version, includes measures to benefit everything from bow and arrow makers in Wisconsin to the overseas operations of computer maker Hewlett-Packard. Well, Illinois Congressman Donald Manzullo led 11 House Republicans opposing the bill, and Congressman Manzullo joins us now. Welcome.
It's good to be with you, Robin.
What's your concern about the bill?
Well, the bill has several problems. First of all, there's a tax cut that is supposed to be geared towards helping out manufacturers keep jobs in America.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the only people that get that tax cut are what are called C corporations, and the little guys are mostly sub-S corporations, LLCs, or sole proprietorships or partnerships.
Well, let's actually give the example that's been given. One example given is that these bow and arrow companies are apparently fleeing to China to avoid the U.S. excise tax of 12%. And so some would say it makes sense to give them a tax break to keep those bow and arrow jobs here. Isn't that true?
It is true. That's a different provision of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
But with regard to general manufacturing, as chairman of the Small Business Committee and as somebody who comes from a heavily industrialized area and who's suffering close to 12% unemployment, we believe that all businesses, large and small, should be given a tax break for keeping manufacturing in the United States. And that's one of the problems with this bill, is that it simply does not do that. It only rewards the C corporations, which are your larger companies, to keep manufacturing here in the U.S.
And do I understand that many of these companies are multinationals and have many of their jobs overseas anyway?
That's correct. But that's a good segue into the second problem, and that is the whole issue of international tax reform. Because what the bill ends up doing inadvertently, and there is some need for international tax reform, is that it ends up rewarding companies for moving manufacturing from the United States to China and then taking the products and bringing them back to the United States, because it reduces income taxes for American companies that manufacture in China and then export back to the United States.
Well, backers of the bill say that it is meant to offset the elimination of export subsidies, which is required by the World Trade Organization, and there's a deadline looming. Doesn't it make sense to make up for some companies losing those subsidies?
Well, first of all, the purpose of the bill is to fix the WTO issue, okay, where the WTO held that the tax that the United States has to favor exporters of American goods, that has to be replaced. But that's easy to fix. All you have to do is come up with a tax code that says if you manufacture in the United States, your taxes will be reduced by X percent, in our case, at least 10%, regardless of whether the items are used domestically or shipped overseas. That fixes the WTO problem. It's this international tax relief, this real confusing tax relief, that's clouding the issue. So we could easily come into WTO compliance by keeping this bill very simple, which it's not. It's been made quite complex.
Mm. Well, Congressman, one last question. In light of the huge deficit,
mm-hmm.
why move to cut corporate taxes at all?
Well, that's a good question, but the issue here is this. If we can incentivize American companies to keep manufacturing in the United States by making them more competitive, by reducing their taxes, then that serves the American worker. So that's my answer to it.
Well, Congressman, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Congressman Donald Manzullo, Republican of Illinois, he's the chair of the House Small Business Committee.
And now to Medicare. Congress is still trying to hammer out legislation that will decide how much elderly Americans will pay for prescription drugs. One among several bones of contention is whether to allow drugs to be imported from other countries, and if so, from where. How the haggling on that point turns out could mean a difference of billions of dollars in profits for the pharmaceutical industry. Well, joining us on the line is Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat from North Dakota. He's the prime sponsor of an amendment now under discussion. Welcome, Senator.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Senator, remind us and our listeners, please, what are the laws on importing drugs?
There is a federal law that prevents the reimportation of prescription drugs except by the manufacturer of the drug.
Now, reimportation, what does that mean?
Or importation. Well, for example, Lipitor, a drug that a lot of Americans take for high cholesterol, is actually made in Ireland and imported into this country. It is imported by the manufacturer, but they sell it not only in this country, they sell it in other countries. If, for example, a pharmacist from Grand Forks, North Dakota, wanted to buy Lipitor from a drugstore in Canada, which sells it at a much lower price, and bring it back and pass savings along to his or her customers, that pharmacist would be violating the law if he re-imported the Lipitor from Canada. Only the manufacturer can bring the Lipitor into this country.
I see. So Americans buying their drugs on the Internet, as many are behaving illegally?
The Customs Service has a history of ignoring a small amount of drugs for personal use that are re-imported by individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very aggressive at enforcing the law with respect to prohibition of reimportation by pharmacists or distributors or others.
Senator, what do you want to do on the question of importing and reimporting pharmaceuticals?
Well, first of all, the U.S. Customer pays the highest prices for prescription drugs in the entire world, and it's unfair. And I'll give you an example. There's a drugstore in Pembina, North Dakota, 5 miles north of there in Emerson, Canada. There's another drugstore. The same pill put in the same bottle made by the same company, FDA approved, has different prices that are radically higher in the U.S. than in Canada.
Yeah.
And yet that pharmacist in the U.S. can't go access that lower priced drug. I want our pharmacists and distributors to be able to purchase that FDA approved drug wherever it is sold. Let the market system provide benefits to the American consumers.
Now, Senator, as you know, the pharmaceutical companies argue that the prices are higher here in the United States because of all the research U.S. pharmaceuticals do, which they say doesn't happen in other countries.
Nonsense. Totally wrong. In fact, the pharmaceutical industry does marginally more research in Europe than they do in the United States, and yet in every single country of Europe, they charge less for the same prescription drugs as they do in the United States. So that is just a totally bogus argument.
Mm-hmm. Now, how are you feeling about what you want to happen? Is it going to happen in this Medicare bill, assuming there's a Medicare bill?
Well, the pharmaceutical industry is big and strong and tough, and they make a lot of money, and they are pretty tough adversaries. They have, over the years, been able to stave off this effort by many of us to allow the reimportation of prescription drugs. I don't know whether we'll win or not. We're pushing very hard.
Finally, Senator, are you getting support from the other side of the aisle, from Republicans?
Oh, absolutely. There are very strong Republican supporters. Congressman Gutnick, a Republican congressman from Minnesota, has been leading the charge over on the Minnesota side. The two senators from Maine, for example, just to use an example, Senator Collins and Snow, both support reimportation, and there are many others as well.
Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat from North Dakota, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Just ahead, life in an Afghan village. Girls used to be married off in their teens, now the age is 7. We'll hear how families are making ends meet.
And later in the show, the book and the movie of Philip Roth's The Human Stain.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In the aftermath of the invasion of Afghanistan, U.S. officials said their motivation, in part, had been to liberate Afghan women. Well, are they? Liberated, that is. What is life in an Afghanistan village like? Diane Mazarana is a researcher at the Fletcher School at Tufts University in Massachusetts. She's traveled the Afghan countryside. She's headed back, but before leaving, Diane joins us from the studios of KUFM in Missoula, Montana. And Diane, let's start by asking about an encounter you had on the outskirts of a village in Afghanistan. You'd stopped for lunch with your Afghan guides. The villagers sent out two old women and then a couple of shepherd boys who sort of just watched you. You found out later why.
Right. Well, what it turned out later was that the day before, a group of armed bandits had come to this village, and they had said that they were with the Afghan government, and they were there to disarm the population. Now it was safe. The population should give up their weapons. So after the village had given up all their weapons and the bandits were sure that they didn't have any weapons, they robbed everyone. Mm. And what some of the men who resisted were brought out and in front of everyone else, beaten very badly to show what would happen to people who resisted. So then when we showed up the next day, we again came in two cars like these bandits had. And so the village said, well, what to do? So they decided the two oldest women in the village should go out and see what happened. And they came back. They said, well, there's a woman. We think it's okay, but send out the children. So then the children kept an eye on us as well.
They're sort of having to make it up as they go along and take care of themselves.
I mean, these people have to rely on themselves. There hasn't been a government for 30 years.
And there's a lot of poverty. You also talked to people who were sending their boys to Pakistan and selling their girls as child brides.
Yes. One of the things we're looking at is trying to understand what we in this business call coping mechanisms. What do you do to get by? And can the international community then build on those strategies? And what we found is an increase of sending boys, particularly young boys, into Pakistan, Iran, and Saudi Arabia for carpentry work or domestic labor. Often these boys are being smuggled, which is quite dangerous for them. And then it's very difficult for the parents to get the boys back. And we're also seeing, which is particularly disturbing to me, is a real drop, it appears, a real drop in the age of marriage of girls. And some of these daughters are being married at 6 and 7 and 8.
Because they get the money
right
then, even if the little girl maybe doesn't even leave the home for a while. And if she does leave the home, she might become a domestic servant in the family she's going to wed into.
Right. They have a practice called bride price in Afghanistan, which is that girls' families are given a price for the girl, and that would depend on what kind of resources that girl has access to, the status of her family, how desirable she is, these things. Mm. I interviewed one woman who was the female head of the local shura, like a local council. She had sold off all of her four girls from ages 7 to about 13 or 12 or 13. Her mother, the grandmother of the girls, pointed to the littlest one and said, when she's married, when they get the full bride price, we're going to eat well off that one. Mm. And so the mother was very unhappy. I mean, no mother is very pleased about the situation for their daughters.
You've said you can't understand what's happening in Afghanistan if you don't use a gender analysis.
That's correct.
What do you mean by that?
All societies are structured based on notions of gender. In Afghanistan, it's very pronounced. Many of the women that I've worked with are not allowed to leave their village. The conditions have not changed since the departure of the Taliban.
They can't go to health clinics because they're outside the village, can't go to the police station, which might be 15 minutes away.
The thing is that it depends. In the more rural areas where I'm working, the women don't even know the police exists. They're not allowed to go to the markets. They're not allowed to go to school. They're not allowed outside of that space. The police may as well be on the moon.
You encountered whole villages where the economy was just devastated, and the whole thing was floating on credit.
What's also interesting is it appears that women are given higher rates of interest, especially vulnerable women like widows, because they would have little recourse. So one woman was being charged 100% interest a week, and they told her if she didn't come up with the money, which there was no way she could, they were going to come to her house and take her carpets. And then she said when they saw her on the street the week before I talked with her, they had taken her shoes off her feet.
Did you see any joy? It sounds like everyone's in a daze and sort of functioning
you know, hand to mouth.
People definitely have things that make them happy. The women wear and they make very beautiful beaded necklaces. They paint their eyes with charcoal, even the eyes of the children. They laugh a lot. The women joke a lot. The men are very funny. In the evenings, we'll sit with groups of Afghan men and have a meal. Mm. They're hilarious. They tell the funniest stories.
Mm. It sounds as if even though the women are oppressed, they fuel the economy. They make the carpets. They make the embroidery. They pick the opium poppy, which is making them very ill.
Yeah.
And the men, what do?
Well, the men often out-migrate for work. They may be gone for months or even years at a time. I don't have a problem finding enough women to work with, but my male colleague often says, I hope there's enough men in this village for me to work with. But yeah, women, one of the things we're finding is that women are really economic and livelihood powerhouses in these areas. Women's labor, it's about 80% of the labor for the poppy production for opium.
How does that make them sick?
Well, there's different ways they can become ill. Weeding the poppies and thinning them is really backbreaking labor, and the women definitely do not enjoy it. They're also in charge of harvesting the poppies and then lancing them to remove the syrup, this kind of sap that comes from it. That is then used to process, usually in Pakistan, used to process into opium. And so with the constant exposure of both the fumes and the syrup itself under their hands, it makes them and their children sick. So the women have said, we're happy to stop this if we can find some other source of cash, some other source of income or livelihood. But opium poppies are one of the few reliable cash crops you have right now in Afghanistan.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Diane Mazarana, researcher with Tufts University's Fletcher School. She is headed back to Afghanistan.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, still reeling from SARS. Hong Kong is a little skittish about the beginning of flu season.
People suddenly think about things that normally only obsessive compulsive people used to think about in terms of, oh my goodness, who touched that doorknob?
And Philip Roth's The Human Stain, the award-winning book, becomes a film starring Anthony Hopkins.
Granted, she's not my first love. Granted, she's not my great love. But she sure as hell is my last love. Doesn't that count for something?
These stories, coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Two people were killed and four others wounded in a large explosion in Baghdad today. That's according to an Iraqi police officer who says an explosive device went off inside a printing shop. The blast shook the capital's old quarter and sparked a huge fire. A deadly snowstorm abruptly ended Indian summer in the Rocky Mountain region, dumping up to 9 inches of snow on parts of Wyoming and Utah and causing temperatures to plunge suddenly by up to 50 degrees. Travel was hazardous across Wyoming with dozens of highway collisions. A pilot was killed when his plane crashed during the storm. The U.S. economy grew at a blistering 7.2% pace in the third quarter of this year. That is its best showing since early 1984. The Commerce Department reports that increase in gross domestic product, the broadest measure of the economy's performance, in the July-September quarter was more than double the 3.3% rate registered in the second quarter. California Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger has been meeting with Vice President Dick Cheney on the state's devastating wildfires. Correspondent Mark Smith reports.
The governor-elect called the meeting a successful one, spent mostly talking with Cheney about expediting federal aid to the affected areas. Speaking with reporters, Schwarzenegger portrayed his Washington visit as part of a two-pronged effort involving the man he's replacing, Governor Gray Davis.
He's working on out there in California, visiting the various different sites while I'm here and trying to get the money from the federal government.
Governor-elect,
a team effort, that's right.
However, as the deadly blazes have raged across more and more acreage, Schwarzenegger has cut short what was originally planned as a series of courtesy calls to return to California. Mark Smith at the White House.
It could be a major victory for Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. The biggest union in the AFL-CIO, the Service Employees International Union, says it will decide next week whether to endorse a candidate. While some union leaders want to delay a decision, a union spokeswoman says if any candidate gets the nod, it will be Dean. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. Dow is up 11 points at 98.86. The Nasdaq is up 3 points at 19.39. And the S&P 500 is down a point at 10.46. It is 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Americans can be forgiven for asking, whatever happened to SARS? But in other countries, the tension around this sometimes fatal disease has not abated. Legislators in Hong Kong are calling for a new inquiry into the government's handling of the severe acute respiratory syndrome outbreak last spring, saying top officials should be accountable for their mistakes. This as Hong Kong works overtime preparing for a new outbreak of SARS. Joining us from Hong Kong is Business Week reporter Frederick Balfour. Frederick, there haven't been new cases in months, but it sounds like it's still a raw issue in Hong Kong.
Oh, it's very much a raw issue. It's still a situation where you sneeze in an elevator and people sort of shrink all around you. Furthermore, with the temperatures dropping in northern China and the fact that we're so entirely vulnerable to this huge amount of cross-border traffic, People are very much concerned. They've got their masks basically at the ready.
And you've written about some pretty interesting measures that companies are taking. There's sort of a cottage industry that seems to have sprung up around preventing SARS.
Well, there certainly is, and I guess that the main thrust of it is teaching people hygiene. Where I work, for example, they completely refitted the bathrooms. They've got faucets that they turn on and off automatically.
So you don't have to touch a faucet and catch something from someone?
Exactly. People suddenly think about things that normally only obsessive compulsive people used to think about in terms of, oh my goodness, who touched that doorknob?
Do we understand that some companies are actually installing monitors to check people's temperatures as they walk in a building?
There are some cases where people are monitoring the temperatures of their employees coming and going. But, of course, that's pretty much a way of life here because whenever you come through the airport, automatically your temperature is read.
What are some other measures that companies are taking?
Some of the corporations, for example, the large U.S. investment banks, what they're doing is keeping contingency sites. If someone should become infected in the main work area, they're able to evacuate all of their staff, move them to another floor, which has been designated as the safe area, and there's very little interruption in their day-to-day activities. Other companies equipped all of their employees with computers that they can take home and log on to the company intranet. So should they have to work from home instead of coming into the office, they're still able to perform their jobs.
They're figuring out ways to address SARS but keep their production going.
Absolutely. There's an acceptance here that SARS is probably going to return in some form, but it doesn't mean that it has to be nearly as disruptive as it was the first time around. And that's why there has been a great demand for consultants who can come into the workplace and sort of say, okay, you're vulnerable because of the way this bathroom door opens or because of the way the desks are faced and so on.
Well, we know that the new inquiry, as you've written, is being launched. What are people hoping to find out?
There's still a lot of unanswered questions about why the authorities were so slow to respond, particularly within the hospitals. They were very ill-equipped to quarantine these patients, and what happened was that a great deal of the spread of the disease occurred within the hospitals, and one of the reasons for that was they only had 60 quarantine beds, and at one time they had over 1,500 suspected SARS cases, and there were no designated hospitals at the time. The head of the health department is the person that most people feel should be held accountable, and so far he has not really taken responsibility for what is widely perceived as mismanagement of the crisis.
Hmm. Well, Frederick, thanks so much for informing us.
You're very welcome.
Frederick Balfour, a reporter for Business Week magazine, he spoke to us from Hong Kong.
Either a 32-year-old, non-white, man of Indian heritage or a grandmother with over 20 years of political experience will be Louisiana's next governor. Either way, a woman or a non-white in the governor's mansion will be a first in Louisiana. We've been looking at key gubernatorial races in the South this week, Kentucky and Mississippi in the past 2 days. Now, Louisiana. Joining us on the line is Karen Henderson, news director for NPR station WRKF in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us, Karen. Tell me about the two candidates, the Republican Bobby Jindal and Democrat Kathleen Blanco.
Well, Bobby Jindal is kind of a whiz kid when he first came on the scene, brought on by Governor Mike Foster to kind of salvage our health and hospitals system, moved on from there to head the University of Louisiana college system. And then, of course, President Bush took him on. He was an assistant secretary for Health and Human Services under Bush and left that position to run for governor.
32 years old and of Indian, not Native American Indian, but Indian from India heritage, huh?
That's right. His parents immigrated from India.
Hmm. Kathleen Blanco, tell us about her.
Well, she's got about 20 years in government. She's two terms in her final year as lieutenant governor and was a state representative, mother of six, grandmother. She's got quite a number of years in government and is looking now to be the governor.
Karen, what will decide this election? What are the issues that are driving this election?
You know, I'm not sure that issues will be really the thing that drives it so much as what's happening here in the end. There's been kind of an attack that's been launched. What's happening is you have Kathleen Blanco bringing into question Jindal's experience because of his age and his connection to Governor Mike Foster, his biggest supporter. Blanco is using that to question Jindal's real leadership. Is he running his campaign, or is Governor Foster the one that's pulling the strings.
And that sort of thing, throwing sparks, because on the issues, these two Catholics don't disagree on a lot of things. They're both have the same position against abortion. They're conservative on economic issues.
You know, you're right. They do differ a little bit on abortion. Kathleen Blanco favors abortion in the cases of rape and incest and mother's life. And in a recent debate, a difference on taxes surfaced. Kathleen Blanco's left the door open for the possibility, saying she'd consider a tax increase if the state got into trouble with health care or education. Jindal, on the other hand, said he couldn't think of a situation when he would support a tax increase.
Now, we've looked at Kentucky and Mississippi, the races there in the past 2 days, where President Bush has cast a long shadow in those races, even becoming something of mini referendums. If the Republican wins, that will be seen as the president's clout having helped the Republican win. Is that the situation in Louisiana?
You know, I don't think President Bush is going to play much into what happens in this race. The Jindal campaign has said if the president comes, he visits, that's fine, but they haven't invited him to come.
In fact, the president was said to be annoyed when Jindal used him in a campaign ad.
Well, that's true. What we're told from Washington, though, is the reason that he was annoyed is more along the lines of the fact that there were several Republicans running. We have an open primary, and that they don't endorse a candidate when there are several Republicans running.
Race, often an issue in a lot of places in the United States. It's been an issue in Louisiana over the years. The race of Jindal an issue?
You know, strangely, with our past, it hasn't been. It hasn't seemed to have been. We have two untraditional candidates for governor for Louisiana, just in the fact that they're not white male.
Mm-hmm. High turnout expected November 15th?
No, actually. If 50% of Louisiana's voters turn out, it'll be a surprise.
Karen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Karen Henderson is news director at WRKF in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Still to come, the book, the movie, The Human Stain.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Listener Bonnie Anderson pointed out a couple of omissions in our segment on the Philadelphia mayor's race. We spoke with Angela Columbus, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, who said that polls showed Mayor Street leading by one percentage point. Bonnie writes, "The reporter should have disclosed that her paper endorsed Republican challenger Sam Katz. In addition, a CBS poll released that same day gave the voter spread as 54% to 37% in favor of Mayor Street."
Errol Wright of Dorchester, Massachusetts, responded to our segment on the ruling by a Nebraska judge that a divorced Mexican-American father can't speak Spanish to his visiting five-year-old daughter. Errol writes, "What the judge in his prejudice doesn't see is the value of the little girl learning to speak another language at an early age. I suppose the judge would see no problem with the mother and or father should they later have to pay for her going to school to learn Spanish."
Well, after our segment on claims of price gouging by the Halliburton Company in Iraq, we received an email from Life Fitzpatrick, a logistics coordinator from Charlotte, North Carolina, further explaining why so-called cost-plus government contracts are an incentive for companies to overcharge the government. We decided to call Life up for a math lesson. Hello, Life.
Hello, how are you doing, Ron?
I'm fine. I've got my calculator right here. Now, first of all, cost plus, that means companies are paid for their cost, say the cost of buying oil, plus a percentage, a bonus, if you will, above that cost. So in the case of Halliburton's subsidiary, it's estimated they're paid about 7% above costs. So take us through the math.
Okay, if we just use rough numbers, we'll just say they could have paid $1 per gallon, and they shipped 100 million gallons.
All right.
Based on that, our cost is $100 million. And their 7% profit is $7 million.
Hold on. Yes, $7 million. Okay.
Now, if they increase their cost to $2 per gallon and deliver the same 100 million gallons, we are actually paying now $200 million. And their 7% profit doubles to $14 million.
So they get reimbursed for the costs of the oil, even though it's double what they could have paid, hypothetically.
Correct.
And they then get a bonus of double, or $14 million.
Which is double what the profits would have been at a dollar.
We received several emails following Robin's interview in Vietnam with a man named Kong. Bob Piantiosi of Andover, Massachusetts writes, This piece so vividly shows that all over this world there are people who are mostly very much like us, maybe hoping that their children and grandchildren will have just a little bit of a better life. Thank you. It was a pleasure listening over your shoulder.
And finally, our story on the 100th anniversary of Jordan Hall in Boston brought this response from David Wright of Wellesley, Massachusetts. Jordan Hall, 100 years of listening to music sideways. Well, seating plan aside, that was a nice tribute, and it warmed my heart to hear the music of my favorite neglected composer, George Whitefield Chadwick. Play some more. Okay, happy to oblige. Here is Chadwick's Melpomene.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Philip Roth's novel, The Human Stain, won the Penn Faulkner Award as the best work of American fiction in 2001. The novel's set in the United States in 1998. I need only say the name Monica to remind you what the major story of that year was and perhaps to recapture the country's pre-9/11 obsessions. The main character is Coleman Silk, a classics professor, forced out of his job by accusations of racism, which is the main theme in a book that's also a complex and masterful dissection of American sexuality, identity, and political correctness. The book is now a movie. We'll talk about that in our next segment. But first, to talk about the novel, we're joined by Here and Now's literary critic, Steve Almond. Welcome, Steve.
How you doing?
The book's set, as we said, very specifically in 1998, what was on the country's mind then. But it's also all about enduring American dilemmas and conflicts, right?
Well, absolutely. And it has, as does most of Philip Roth's work, a tremendous amount of commentary. Mishnah is probably what one of his characters might call it. I think most people agree that this is a major return to form for Roth in that he's not just writing about personal dilemmas. He's actually writing about the zeitgeist at that time and capturing the way in which the larger political discourse also intersects with personal fate.
Many consider him the greatest American novelist right now. It is a great and a fierce book, right?
It's absolutely fierce, and one of the problems in translating it to the screen, we should qualify by saying neither of us has seen it, of course, is that I fear that some of the most pointed accusations and jabs are not going to make it to the screen.
You've got to wonder, is this a book that's a natural candidate to have a movie made about it?
Well, I think the subject is a natural candidate because it has to do very much with the American identity and a lot of issues that people immediately recognize are plucked straight from the zeitgeist. I would argue that it's not a natural in a literary sense. Three-quarters of this book is really are entirely interior monologues through a series of voices, and they're so complicated and overlapping that my hunch is that they'll be vastly simplified in the film.
Steve, this is not then maybe a natural for a movie, but there is at the heart of it a secret, is there not, which of course we're not going to reveal for future readers of the book or viewers of the movie, but there is a device that turns everything, and maybe that does make it potentially
a movie.
Ah, yes, the famous MacGuffin. My argument would actually be that particular device, which is a very, it's a huge surprise in the book, is going to seem even more distracting and unrealistic on film. Without getting into the intricacies of it, it really bears on a basic issue of verisimilitude. That is, does the viewer or the reader believe it? I very much doubt that viewers of a film, who are after all not going to be making the characters up in their head, but staring at Anthony Hopkins and Nicole Kidman and already having to perform that act of conversion and say, that isn't Nicole Kidman, that's a character named Fauna Farley, she's actually kind of homely and she's been abused and so forth, they're already having to make that leap of faith. And my sense is that it's going to be much more difficult to pull off what Roth is able to do with the reader's willing participation in the book.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Steve Almond is Here and Now's regular literary critic.
Well, the task of bringing the human stain to film went to Academy Award-winning director Robert Benton of Kramer vs. Kramer fame. Anthony Hopkins plays Classics professor Coleman Silk, stripped of his job because of accusations of racism. And Nicole Kidman is the working-class woman with the troubled past who leads him to confront buried aspects of his past. Recently, we spoke to director Robert Benton about the human stain. We began with what to do about that pivotal secret.
Philip Roth doesn't reveal the twist until a little over a third of the way through the book. And it took me by surprise when I read it. And I want the audience to have that same sense of surprise, because you can never take a book and literally translate it into a film. You have to pick and choose among all the many complicated and wonderful themes, those few themes that make the point you want to make.
Mm. Let's listen to a scene first. We have a clip here of Anthony Hopkins as Coleman Silk defending his relationship with Fauna Farley to his friend Nathan Zuckerman, who's played by Gary Sinise. Let's listen.
Don't you look at me like that. I'm your friend, remember?
And I'd like a friend! Stop judging me and stop judging her!
So what do you want me to say? Granted, she's not my first love. Granted, she's not my great love. But she sure as hell is my last love. Doesn't that count for something?
All that powerful acting. Is a director almost afraid to enter the set? how do you approach this incredible ensemble?
This is a movie that belongs to the actors. I mean, we cast very carefully, and we were very lucky in that the people we wanted said yes.
It's also an Anthony Hopkins that we're not used to seeing.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, Hopkins had never played a love story before. He'd never kissed a woman on screen before.
And here you have him in bed with Nicole Kidman.
Yes. I think one of the things that drew him to the project was the idea is that he was going to get to do things that he had never done before on film.
But is that, as a director, you thinking, oh, I would love to, I mean, this is going to come out wrong, but I would love to get Anthony Hopkins in bed in a romance. I mean, is that something you're thinking of in a creative way?
Yes,
like, I want to see that.
Yes, you think, who do you want to see in these relationships?
Yeah.
Who fits in a way that's not simply erotic, but is it really interesting?
Also, as far as seeing actors in interesting combinations, there's another scene with Gary Sinise in which they're dancing to the song Cheek to Cheek.
In the book, one of the things in reading Philip Roth's great book that made me very anxious to do it is a moment where Coleman Silk, a man in his late 60s, and his friend Nathan are sitting talking on the back porch of Coleman's house on a summer night, and he turns to Nathan. He said, "Let's dance." And it's this wonderful scene of these two men dancing.
How did they feel about it?
A week or so before we were going to shoot it, Anthony said, "You know, I've never done something like this. I'm nervous. I will do it, but would you mind closing the set?" Now, in a movie, you only close a set when there is a scene of such emotional weight that the actor needs total quiet or there's nudity. And I understood, I mean, this man has done everything. This man's one of the great actors alive of all time. And so, of course, we closed the set.
Wow.
And I had friends coming up that day, and I said, "I'm sorry, you can't come." And we started shooting around midnight. And once we'd done the first take, both Anthony and Gary realized how good they were and what a great scene they had just done. Then they started pulling people off the street to see it. You know, it was a wonderful time. And they kept, once we had it, I said, "Okay, we've got enough." They said, "Oh, let us keep doing it. Let's improvise." And so they kept dancing. They literally danced all night.
And one up-and-coming in the movie, the fellow who plays the young Coleman, there were some unique demands for his part.
The actor who plays the young Coleman so much match up with Anthony Hopkins, but he also has to be the doorway into the secret of Coleman's past. And in order to make that work, we needed not only someone who was legitimate, this person, but could act, and you would believe he had the weight and strength of Anthony Hopkins. And I was terrified of that, because this is asking of an actor in the early 20s to have the control and the depth and the richness of an actor in his 60s. And when we found Wentworth Miller, the producer called me and said, I found the actor. And I said, wait a minute, okay, you're the producer, I'm the director. The director's supposed to find the actor, okay? And
I'll be the judge of that.
I'll be the judge of that, right? We'll see about that. And I went out to meet Wentworth with a real chip on my shoulder, and as soon as I saw him work, it was just amazing.
Well, author Philip Roth has said the title, The Human Stain, refers to the mark that we all leave on the world. So what's your mark?
I don't really have a clue of what my mark on the world is, except to be a sort of passable husband and a mediocre father.
Well, Robert Benton, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
For all your work, thank you. Academy Award-winning director Robert Benton's newest film is The Human Stain. It's based on the novel by Philip Roth.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Metzen, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Jordan Augustison, Brad Fritz, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild's our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Strapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Ann Stevenson and Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news in these stories Here and Now.
The Supreme Court considers the case without a public record. It's the first of the post-9/11 cases to make its way to the high court.
And what's your favorite scary movie?
Repulsion. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.